Do you dread spending your Saturday haggling with a car salesperson? Well, I know that I do. I find the whole idea of negotiating at the car dealership stressful. With Carvana, you can skip the dealership and buy your next car online. Choose as soon as next day delivery or pickup from the world's first coin-operated car vending machine. Enjoy the peace of mind of a 7-day return policy, plus save some serious money compared to dealerships. Carvana is the new way to buy a car. Check out carvana.com/rabbits to learn more. carvana.com/rabbits. carvana.com/rabbits. Here at the Public Radio Alliance, we love podcasts. Here are a couple of recommendations from two of our longtime friends in podcasting. Brace yourself for sleepless nightmares. The No Sleep Podcast is one of the most popular horror storytelling podcasts out there. Now in its 7th year, No Sleep takes audio horror storytelling to a new level. Immersive sound design and custom musical scores complement a full cast of voice actors who bring the anthology of creepy tales to life. The multi-award-winning podcast is a perfect way to experience stories that will keep you up at night. The No Sleep Podcast is available everywhere you find podcasts, including Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Visit thenosleeppodcast.com to learn more about the show and find hundreds of hours of archived episodes. Season 2 of The Darkest Night is out now. It is a binaurally recorded and fully scored 360-degree immersive podcast experience like no other. This new season is once again narrated by Lee Pace from Guardians of the Galaxy, Twilight, The Hobbit, and Halt and Catch Fire, and features voice acting from Maynard James Keenan from Tool in a Perfect Circle, RuPaul, Michelle Visage, Jeffrey Bowen Chapman from Unreal, and more. Check out Darkest Night now, wherever you listen to great podcasts.
Ready when you are.
You believe your friend who was playing rabbits?
She started seeing mysterious men in gray.
What did she ask you?
She asked me how many steps to the lighthouse.
About chaos there.
The streets were red, then black with blood.
That sounds poetic. Where are you now?
The bottom line isn't money or purpose. It's inspiration.
Are we still gonna have sex?
I'm afraid not.
She believed Hazel killed Emily Masters.
Maybe later.
For sure, later. I first heard about the game shortly after my best friend, Yumika Takata, disappeared. I started this podcast because I want to find out what happened to my friend. From the Public Radio Alliance and Minnow Beats Whale, you're listening to Rabbits. I'm Carly Parker. Stay with us. Last episode, after beginning a discussion about the Berenstain Bears and his theory about the children of one particular Gatwick Institute study acquiring the ability to slip dimensions during moments of extreme stress, Jones finally told me the story I'd been asking him about. The reason he'd been sent away, or as he put it, thrown away by his parents when he was a kid. He told me it was because he'd burned down his entire town. I asked him what he meant by that, if it was some kind of metaphor. But he told me it was no metaphor. It was fire. His family had been living on a small island in Washington State at the time, a short ferry ride from Seattle. He and his best friend had been working as dishwashers in the island's only restaurant. When Jones overheard his parents talking about separating, he started acting out, yelling at his mother, staying out all night, stealing cars, and eventually lighting fires. One night, after everybody had left the restaurant, Jones set a can of kerosene on the stove, turned on the burner, and left. The can exploded in an unforgiving spray of liquid fire. The fire spread very quickly. The island was small, with a population of less than 1,000, and the fire truck's engine was in the process of being repaired. As Jones stood there watching the blaze, his best friend, who'd re-entered the restaurant through a side door to use the bathroom while Jones was inside, ran out of the building, his entire body engulfed in flames. He died in the middle of the street, a few feet from Jones. Jones later learned that his friend had been listening to loud music in the bathroom, and, of course, he had no idea what Jones was planning. His friend's headphones ended up burned into his head, while Jones stood there, staring, unable to look away. A minute or so later, the gas station connected to the restaurant went up in flames, followed quickly by the post office beside it. At this point, Jones finally turned and ran home as fast as he could. But, like my memory of the swimming pool, when Jones made it back home and told his parents what had happened, they didn't believe him. They took him back to the restaurant to show him, and they were right. Everything was fine. Except everything didn't feel fine to Jones. He was so distraught that they had to have him sedated, and eventually, a few weeks later, when he wouldn't stop raving, they had him admitted to an institution for observation. Even though it looked like nothing had actually happened, arson or murder-wise, Jones's friend never visited Jones in the mental facility. In fact, after the night Jones imagined the fire, his best friend never spoke with him again. Yeah, it actually does sound like Jones and I have a lot in common. We spoke a bit more about his family, but in case you haven't guessed, he asked that I didn't record that part of our conversation. He did allow me to turn on my voice recorder once I kind of changed the subject. Oh, and his parents never did split up. What else can you tell me about our parents and your multiple-dimensional Gatwick world-hopping theory? Why do we remember things they don't?
Well, at first I thought my parents were lying to me.
Yeah, I felt that way too.
When I was older, I wondered if I'd experienced some kind of weird echo or pocket of weirdness.
But you don't think that's it?
No. All right, so stay with me. This is going to get a bit out there.
Oh, I think we're already way out there.
Okay. So, what if, in cases of extreme stress or duress, the offspring of the participants from Gatewick Institute Research Subproject R7 are able to slip into another version of reality? Identical in every aspect other than the event that caused them distress. The world remains the same for everyone around them. The only thing different is the source of the stress is gone. Erased.
That sounds interesting, scary, and extremely improbable.
That's what I thought. At first.
And it's also scientifically impossible.
Yeah, but not theoretically scientifically impossible.
Multiple world theory?
Among other quantum theories, yes, but what if there was a trigger, something that activated this ability?
What was Subproject R7?
It was one of the programs our parents were involved in.
The MKUltra type thing?
One of them, yes. I'm going to tell you about a dream I've been experiencing consistently ever since I was a kid.
Does this have anything to do with that dream Alan Scarpio mentioned?
Yes.
Tell me.
Okay. It starts off on a beach. A lonely gray day, overcast. The waves are rolling in, loud and powerful. I'm looking across the water. It's cool outside. Not exactly cold, but definitely not tropical. I hear the sound of wings beating from above, and I turn to see an eagle. But as it moves closer, I realize it's not an eagle. It's a giant raven. And this thing is huge. It screeches out a gnarled caw and flies off above the endless dense forest that runs parallel to the beach. Both the beach and the dark green forest appear to go on forever. After a moment, I turn and follow the giant bird. I can't help myself, and although it feels extremely dangerous, I turn and walk straight into the thick green forest.
Jones.
Stay with me. I walk for quite a while before I come to a small clearing. There is a polished concrete structure standing there, in the center. It has some kind of sliding metal door, and next to the door, a small silver button. I approach the structure slowly, carefully, taking the time to walk all the way around, examining every inch of the thing. But it appears to be nothing more than a 5x5 polished stone structure with a sliding door. So, I press the button. There's a distant click followed by a whirring sound, and then, a few seconds later, the sliding door opens. I step into a small metal room. It's cold inside, and I cross my arms to try to stay warm. The sliding door closes, and a light flickers from above. Then, something happens.
You start to move.
Yes.
It's an elevator.
Yes.
Who told you about this?
I told you. It's a reoccurring dream.
That's impossible. The beach, the bird, the forest, the concrete structure, the elevator, everything. It's my dream.
No. It's our dream.
Are you hiring? Do you know where you should post to find the best candidates for the position? Finding great talent can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, and they do this better than anyone else. ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use website helps you find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. And ZipRecruiter already has 9 million resumes you can search through in their database. How does this sound? Did your drinking buddy suddenly turn into his dead missing brother? Do you love global arcane mysteries, long walks in the woods, and herbal tea? Contact Nick Silver at the Public Radio Alliance. Avoid juggling emails and calls to your office. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, Rabbits listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/rabbits. That's ZipRecruiter.com/rabbits. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/rabbits. Squarespace is the best, and that's why we use Squarespace to make every single website here at the Public Radio Alliance. We need a lot of websites, and Squarespace is so easy, clean, and elegant. Squarespace just works, and because we use Squarespace for everything, our sites look good wherever you happen to be looking at them. Laptops, desktops, or mobile devices. Their incredible award-winning designer templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. If you have a passion that you obsess over, like running down the street against your better judgment, chasing mysterious figures in gray, or selling old VHS copies of movies that may have never existed online, whatever it is that keeps you up at night, that drives you creatively, you need to get it out there. If you need a domain as well, Squarespace offers a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and easy to set up. So, share your ideas with the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code RABBITS to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code RABBITS. Squarespace. Make your next move. Jones had a recurring dream he's had ever since he was a child. A dream about a beach, a forest, and an elevator. I've had the same dream, hundreds of times, ever since I was a kid. Every physical detail and each emotional response was exactly the same. I told my parents, my brother, and Yumiko about the dream. But I never told anyone else. Jones told me that he'd met one other person who'd experienced the same dream. The only other person he was able to track down whose parents took part in the same Gatwick Institute research study. R7. She described exactly the same dream. I asked Jones if he knew how to get in touch with her. He told me she passed away a long time ago. I asked Jones if he could log on to the Darknet forum that could seemingly somehow answer questions through the Marigold radio broadcast from the past. But the forum was gone. It had been shut down. It looked like we weren't going to be getting any more answers from the past from Marigold. Alan Scarpio told me that if I wanted to learn more about rabbits and Yumiko, I would have to come back to see him, alone. When I drove back out to his ranch, they told me that he had to fly out to take care of something, and that he would meet me at his place in Seattle later this afternoon. He took care of booking us a flight. We were back in Seattle 2 hours later. Scarpio had a car waiting for us in Seattle. In the car, on our way to my place, after dropping Jones off at his apartment, my friend Anna, who works at the Seattle Public Library, the last place Yumiko had been seen, called with an update. The book called Strange Adventures in the Rag Trade by Arnold Milne, the book that Yumiko had checked out, had just been returned. I asked the driver to take me to the library immediately. I needed to see that book. There was nothing special about it, on the surface. It was a simple blue hardcover book with a graphic of some kind of textile machine on the cover. It had been published by a now defunct company called Upright Media Publications in England in 1970. The book was old and still contained the old envelope and card in the back, a card that had been placed there when the book was brand new. It looked like this book had only been taken out a few times before the card catalog system was retired for the modern computerized system we use today. There were three names on the card: Bobby Miller, Ronald Salverson, and Nikki Fedora. I took the book out, of course, and while I was checking it out, I saw the book's Dewey Decimal catalog number. It was 687.8.
That's definitely interesting.
What does this book have to do with Yumiko? Why did she take it out?
I don't know.
This stuff is really getting kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Even in the middle of the day, walking down a busy street, I feel like I'm not safe. Like part of me no longer understands the world.
Like Keanu walking around in the Matrix.
I wasn't going there, but that kind of fits, sure.
The number 6878 appears again.
Another coincidence.
There should be something else.
The number's not enough?
Well, at this point, if we're on the right path, the information should be converging as well.
More clues? Like, where the hell is my friend?
I feel like there should be more, yeah.
There are some folded dog-eared pages.
Well, that could be something.
Okay, I'm writing down the page numbers. First letters of each word and everything else I can think of.
Good idea.
Did you find anything on the names?
Nothing yet.
What if they're not real names?
What do you mean?
I mean, here, what's the first one? Jones didn't have any luck digging up anything on the names from the card in the back of the book. But what if we weren't looking at them the right way? I started rearranging the letters in each of the names. It didn't take me long to find it.
Radio knife.
Nikki Fedora is an anagram for radio knife. Okay, what does that mean?
Radio knife was the winner of four.
No, I know that. I mean, what does it mean as far as finding Yumiko?
It means that we're on the right path.
That's it?
It's a sign of convergence.
So you don't think this specific coincidence is tied directly to Yumiko's disappearance?
Probably not directly, no.
But it's the clue we've been looking for, right?
Maybe. But I don't think so.
So what now?
Now? Now we keep digging.
And dig, we did. I went through all of the page numbers and the first letter of each word on every page, and eventually, I found something.
I took the page number. Let's say it was 7. Then I wrote down the first letter of the 7th word on that page, and so on. By the time I'd made it through all of the dog-eared pages, I had something. An address. Somebody, perhaps Yumiko, folded some of the pages of a book called Strange Adventures in the Rag Trade by Arnold Milne. Those folded pages led to an address. That address was a diner in Seattle. I called Jones and told him what I'd found. He agreed, or rather, insisted upon, coming with me. Is this the place?
This is it.
The Rosethorn Diner was located in downtown Seattle. The exterior looked like an old movie theater, and the interior was a strange blend of cool 50s and 80s kitsch that really worked. There was a lot of black and white.
Coffee? Yes, please. You?
Do you have tea?
Yeah, sure. My shift's just ending, but I'll get Melanie to bring you the same one you had last time.
Thanks.
You've been here before?
Once or twice.
Okay. So what now?
I don't know. I guess we just look around.
For what?
I don't know.
6878?
I don't imagine it'll be that simple.
No. I suppose not.
We took photos of the numbers on the menu and the art on the walls. We looked for messages carved into or written on the tables, but we couldn't find anything. I asked our new server, Melanie, if she remembered seeing Yumiko. I showed her a picture. She said that she didn't remember her. She took my phone and showed Yumiko's picture to her boss and the cook. Nobody remembered seeing Yumiko, but Melanie told me that most of the regular staff had the day off. It looked like this place was a dead end. We had a bit of a drive ahead of us, so before we left, I decided to use the bathroom. There was a lot written on the wall of that bathroom stall, so it took me a while to find it. It was about halfway up, drawn in black Sharpie. A winking smiley face. A winking smiley face that I'd seen drawn on the front of countless binders, Converse high tops, and skateboards. It was essentially Yumiko's signature from when we were kids. Right below the smiley face, drawn with the same felt pen, was a pyramid. The smiley face on top of the pyramid looked like a version of the moonrise. Inside the pyramid were a bunch of tiny 4-digit numbers. I had no idea what kind of weird clue this was supposed to be. I pulled Jones into the ladies' bathroom to take a look at the stall.
What do you think?
I think it's a message.
How would she know to leave me a message here?
Well, what makes you think it's a message for you?
Nobody else would recognize that smiley face.
I suppose that makes sense.
We each took a bunch of pictures of the stall. It was weird, standing in the ladies' bathroom with a man taking pictures. Thankfully, nobody walked in. I left Jones at the restaurant. I had a private date with a billionaire. Springtime is a great time to hit the reset button and re-tackle personal goals like getting fit,
cleaning, and cooking. Luckily, Blue Apron makes incredible home cooking easy and accessible by delivering seasonal recipes with step-by-step instructions and pre-portioned ingredients right to your door, all for less than $10 per meal. You can even customize your recipes based on your preferences and select a delivery option that's right for you. Plus, there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. I love Blue Apron because it's delicious and inspiring after a long day spent flipping through old popular science magazines looking for clues to an ancient, mysterious game, but also because I've learned how to cook so many amazing things. Some of the meals available in June include warm smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons, spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice, elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice, and peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. Blue Apron shows up at your door with all the ingredients individually packaged and ready to go, along with clear, easy-to-follow, inspiring instructions on how to prepare everything. Check out this week's menu to get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/rabbits. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/rabbits. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. These days, you can practically get everything on demand, like our podcast. Listen whenever you want, whenever it's convenient for you. So why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? We use Stamps.com here at the Public Radio Alliance because Stamps.com makes everything incredibly easy, but also because we want to save time and money. Stamps.com is convenient, easy, reliable, and flexible. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. Print postage for letters or packages at your convenience, 24/7. So whether you're sending out letters asking for help decoding a message hidden in a box of cereal from the 1970s, or you're sending fan mail to your favorite podcast, you know, the podcast about that potentially mythic, strange, and ancient game, you need to save time and money. You need Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code RABBITS for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Get started with Stamps.com today, and within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in RABBITS. That's Stamps.com. Enter RABBITS. With Stamps.com, you'll never have to go to the post office again. Thanks for seeing me again. I'm sure you must be extremely busy.
Well, nobody's busier than anybody else.
Well, I'm not sure that's exactly true.
We're all busily avoiding death together, aren't we?
I suppose so.
Is there something specific that you'd like to know?
Well, my friend Yumiko was looking into Hazel and the murder of Emily Masterson.
She believed Hazel killed Emily Masterson.
Yeah. How did you know?
It was a popular theory at the time.
Can you tell me anything else about what happened or what was happening around that time?
1998, that was a long time ago.
What about that ROM you sent to Yumiko?
I was asked to send that package to somebody named Yumiko at that address. That's it.
Are you in the habit of just sending random packages?
Well, depends who's asking.
Who asked this time?
Nobody. It was an exchange.
An exchange of what?
Information.
What information?
Unrelated to you or your friend. I needed something, and somebody wanted something in return.
What somebody?
It was all online. Anonymous.
Fine. What did you think of what was on the ROM?
I didn't see it.
You knew Yumiko's face was on there.
I listened to your podcast.
Oh.
I'm really enjoying it. I can't wait to see how it ends.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I just sent that package to the gym. There are rules.
Whose rules? The warden's? Scarpio just smiled. Apparently he didn't want to discuss the warden's. I pulled out my laptop and showed him the photos I'd taken of the Defender 2 ROM.
The logic board was actually Defender 2?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
What do you think?
I assumed you've looked carefully at the photos of these graphics.
Of course. I took them.
And what did this one tell you?
He pointed to the photo of the WTF screen, with the name Hazel, the graphic of the rabbit, and the words, "Find Harley, Gone Hunting." What about it?
It doesn't work like that.
What doesn't work like what?
You have to expend some effort, some energy to figure this stuff out. That's the spirit of the game. That's what the game requires from you. It's a kind of covenant.
I just want to find my friend.
What did you find in that library book?
A code that led to an address.
And what do you see when you look at these words and pixels?
Just words and pixels.
Look closer.
For what?
Hazel.
What about Hazel?
I'm afraid that's all I can tell you, Carly. You're gonna have to figure the rest out on your own.
That's it? Please, I just want to find my friend.
Your friend was working with somebody else.
Who?
Look closer.
That was all I got from Alan Scarpio. He handed back my laptop. He had zoomed in on the graphic of the rabbit, the word Hazel below it, the words "Find Harley, Gone Hunting" below that. "Look closer," he said. So I did. I stared at the image, zoomed in and out and all around, typed the words and phrases into every type of translation and search engine I could find. It wasn't until I thought back to a question Alan Scarpio had asked me earlier. How did I find the address via that library book? Numbers and letters. "Find Harley, Gone Hunting. FHGH 6878. So, another coincidental appearance of that number. Or perhaps I'm looking so hard for connections that I'm seeing things that might not be there. I switched to the pictures we'd taken of the bathroom stall, looking at the tiny four-digit numbers surrounding the graffiti. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't turn them into anything that made sense. And no, none of them were 6878. I went back to the pictures of the Defender 2 ROM. It took me another hour or so to find something else. Something that was definitely there. The graphic of the rabbit was made up of pixels. There were lit pixels and spaces made up of black or empty pixels. I zoomed in and went through the entire image of that rabbit,
line by line, and type the results into Notepad. Using a 1 for each lit pixel and a 0 for each black pixel, I typed out a whole bunch of binary code. When I inserted that code into a binary to text converter, I found a URL. I typed that URL into a browser. Nothing. I loaded a Tor browser and added .onion to the end of the extremely long link. The result? A photograph. It was a photo of Hazel, or more accurately, a photo of Hazel and Emily Masterson. I called Jones immediately and asked him to come over.
What's up?
I went back over to Alan Scarpio's place.
And?
And he was weird and cryptic again.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Find Harley gone hunting. FHGH 6878.
That was from the Stargate ROM.
Defender 2, yeah.
That's interesting. Anything else? Carly.
There was also this. I handed Jones my laptop with the photo of Hazel and Emily Masterson. He stared at the screen for a long time. He appeared to be visibly struck by the image. His eyes looked different. He was shaken. He handed back my laptop, and I was once again looking at the photo of Hazel and Emily Masterson. Jones was Hazel.
Where did you find this?
I've got a few questions I'd like to ask first, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Okay, let's start with this. The girl who had the same dream as us. The girl with the Gatwick Institute R7 parents who died. It was Emily Masterson, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, next question. What the fuck is going on?
Just as I was about to win, or complete the 8th iteration of Rabbits, just before the convergence, in 2007, my girlfriend, Emily Masterson, died in what appeared to be a freak accident.
You were about to win. Emily wasn't playing?
Not officially, but unofficially, she was invaluable. She helped me. A lot. She was important to me.
Okay, I don't want to come off as insensitive here, but you...
What?
You didn't have anything to do with her death, right?
I had everything to do with it.
What do you mean?
I mean, if I hadn't dragged her to England to help me win the game, she'd still be alive.
Yumiko believed you had something to do with Emily's death. Something more sinister.
Yes.
You knew that?
Yes. I knew that she believed Hazel had purposely killed Emily Masterson. As Jones, I was helping Yumiko, or trying to help her uncover the truth. But the 9th version of Rabbits is corrupt. Things aren't the same. When Yumiko found the same photo you did, she kind of freaked out.
She learned you were Hazel.
Yes.
And she ran.
Yes.
From you.
In part, yes.
In part?
Yumiko had become convinced that somebody was following her. Somebody else.
Wardens?
Possibly. She was becoming confused.
I don't understand why she didn't feel she could talk to me about all of this stuff.
It's against the rules.
You play the game, you never tell.
Yes.
But I'm telling with this podcast.
Yes.
Okay. Help me understand. What's happening here? What's going on?
When Emily died, I stopped playing the game and went into hiding. I didn't know it at the time, but something happened. It took me a long time to figure out that it may have had something to do with me either quitting the game when I did, or Emily's death, or my experiencing the stress of that event, or perhaps some combination of all of those things, but I now believe that the mechanisms of the game were disturbed somehow, altered at that point. An adjustment was missed that threw things off, pulled certain elements off course.
Our universe or dimension was off somehow?
I think so. I think it had become corrupt, although I didn't think of it in those terms at that time.
What happened after you quit playing?
Like I said, I didn't notice anything at first.
Sorry, I mean, what happened with you, personally?
Oh, right. Well, I began to rebel against order, I suppose. I'd spent my entire life looking for order, trying to make sense out of the chaos of life, and after Emily's death, I started a kind of crusade against the world. Against everything.
WTF. Where is our future?
Yeah. I became obsessed with doing something to help a world I felt had lost its way. Its identity.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I was young. I came up with ideas, things I genuinely thought would help.
A revolution.
Kind of thing, yeah.
How did that work out?
It didn't take long for certain types to take up the cause of their own. Although I created the movement, I wasn't actively engaged in the whole WTF thing for very long. It kind of took on a life of its own pretty quickly.
It went viral.
Well, among a very small group of people, yes.
People who wanted change.
And I wanted change. True and valuable change, but as the years passed, the more I looked into certain things, the more I examined patterns within the complex systems of certain cities and governments, I began to suspect that things had veered seriously off track.
Things were off?
Way off. And at this point, I began to suspect that I had something to do with it.
With rabbits?
Yes. When 9 started. I could tell immediately that something was wrong. Very wrong. 9 was more dangerous. The game was infected. An adjustment that had been missed needed to be made.
What kind of adjustment?
Based on everything I was seeing and everything I'd learned about the game up to that point, I began to suspect that we were headed towards something final. Entropy. The end. It was as if the Earth was suddenly moving toward the sun in complete annihilation, and nobody had a clue that it was happening. At that point, I decided to switch my focus from political and social change to simple survival. Our survival.
This dimension was, what, breaking apart?
Dying, yes.
Okay, so you were trying to save the world by helping facilitate some kind of interdimensional adjustment, slipping us over onto the right track.
It sounds pretty dramatic, I know.
What makes you think things changed so much with the ninth iteration of the game?
The players weren't able to participate the same way. Where there used to be clues and signposts, there were now dangerous complications.
Like Yumiko's video.
Exactly. The game had become corrupt, broken. I could see that, but I didn't believe anybody else could. At least not before it was too late. And players were dying and disappearing. It was far more dangerous and chaotic than before. So, I started to help some of the players. Players who were either extremely gifted or whose lives appeared to be threatened by their participation.
Yumiko.
Yes.
Why Yumiko?
I'd started playing the game again myself by this point, examining the clues, looking for the patterns, for the convergence.
And that led you to Yumiko?
That's what I thought, at first.
At first? What do you mean?
I believed that everything had been leading me to Yumiko. That it would be possible, working with Yumiko, to follow the signs and markers to eventually uncover the point of convergence, to facilitate the slip. But that wasn't the case.
No?
No. Everything had actually been leading me somewhere else.
Where?
To you.
To me?
Yumiko, Monica Morelli, and many, if not all, of the other participants in the game had been corrupted, confused, and eventually they all died or disappeared.
All of them?
All of them but you.
And you?
Yes.
Why?
I believe it's related to our parents' involvement with the Gatewick Institute.
It's genetic?
I believe it is. You should take a look at this.
He pulled up a PDF on his phone and handed it to me. It was a few pages that appeared to contain, among other things, research results from a series of studies. Extremely strange and dangerous studies. Jones believes these Gatewick Institute studies are the real legacy of MKUltra. I'm going to read some excerpts from that PDF for you now. R6 Subject 19 had been compliant until exposure to BSE version 1173. Post-exposure, the subject appeared slightly agitated, but not violent or fearful. 48 hours later, the subject was removed from their room and placed into observation. The subject had attempted to remove their own skin with plastic cutlery taken from the cafeteria. The subject also stared at their nurse for a full minute and then screamed until they passed out. This pattern would repeat until the subject was given enough sedative to curtail the behavior. Recommend closing R6 immediately. The next page. Dr. Wilkinson has changed the formula again. BSE version 1214 includes a number of organic compound changes. The moss taken from forest and material from preserved mammoth tusks found in the ice in Siberia have been combined with Dr. Wilkinson's R5 cuttlefish extract and the base compound from R1. These are the most elaborate series of changes since the program began. Based on Dr. Wilkinson's recommendation, R7 is going to be extremely small. Just 6 in the recipient group and 6 in the control group, for a total of 12 participants. Dr. Pierce has indicated that due to the small size of the R7 group, we should run 2 bisodium ephemeral studies concurrently, R7 and R8. Wilkinson, Agreed. The R7 study produced no results. Both the group who received BSE-1214 and the control group showed no signs of movement through the barrier, no ability to hear the voices or shapes in any alternative dimensional space. The R8 study had significantly different results. The subjects in the R8 control group displayed no behavioral changes, no placebo effect at all. But the subjects in the R8 study who received BSE-1296 experienced significant symptoms, including hallucinations, headaches, extreme dryness in the eyes and mouth, and intense emotional responses to the most innocuous events. Each of the recipients of BSE-1296 also experienced violent outbursts, lucid night terrors, and complained of hearing the deep voice of something they referred to as the Dark Man, the Dragon, or the Dragon Man. Interestingly, each subject described the voice the exact same way, down to the tone and subject of conversation. Recommend closing R7 due to lack of effect, and moving forward with R8 Phase 2, based on a few slight modifications by Drs. Wilkinson and Pierce. The last page of the document was a dream journal from one of the subjects of Research Study R8, subject number 7. I'm going to read that page for you now. I was walking through an old building. There were a whole bunch of rooms. The man with the dragon voice guided me through the long halls, down the stairs, and into a large empty chamber, entirely made of some kind of dark hardwood. In the center of the room was a pile of large wings. They were bloody, and the dragon voice told me they had been ripped from the backs of angels, torn like the wings from a fly. There was somebody else there, in the back of the wooden room. Somebody made of something that wasn't what I was made of. And they were covered in something else. As I slowly approached the figure, I could see that it was made of the other subjects of the study, the ones who had driven out to the woods during the last full moon, the ones who had touched the rock. It wasn't just made of the other subjects' skin and hair. It was also part animal. The ripped and bloodied face of a deer had been roped to its head, and there was another animal fur I couldn't recognize. It gave the entire fleshy, furry, bloody thing the illusion of something feral and old. The room smelled of copper, rancid blood, and old, dusty things uncovered. The story ends there. Written beneath it, in a scrawl of black felt pen, R8 suspended. All other BSE studies shut down indefinitely. But wait, it sounds like the study our parents took part in, study number R7, didn't result in anything happening at all.
It appears that way, but I believe it's actually the opposite.
What do you mean?
I mean, study R7 was different from the others. It involved more organic compound materials treated in unique ways. I believe there was something in there, that they somehow achieved something without knowing it. I just think it took a generation to manifest.
a latent ability that, when combined with super stressful situations, could result in some kind of interdimensional displacement?
That's... yes. Or preventing dimensional displacement.
What do you mean?
I mean, what if the people playing rabbits are disappearing?
Like Yumiko?
Maybe.
What, you think Yumiko's not in this world?
I don't know.
Wow.
What's one possibility?
So, okay. You believe this genetic ability was dormant in the parents, but active in their kids.
Yes. And I know it sounds a little out there.
Well, it sounds way out there.
What about the fact that we shared a dream? You, me, and Emily. That has to mean something, doesn't it?
Okay, but to be fair, Yumiko knew about my dream and could have told you, and I've never met Emily, so...
What are you saying?
I'm saying... I don't know what I'm saying. I guess what I'm saying is... I want to find my friend. Jones went home. He was still worried about the people in gray, or wardens, or whatever they were, and offered to stay and sleep on my couch. I wanted to accept his offer, but I was still a bit freaked out about the whole Jones is Hazel thing, so I told him I was fine, and that I'd call him in the morning. I took another hard look at the photos from that bathroom stall, the tiny numbers inside that pyramid below Yumiko's smiley face. There were dozens of them, small, four-digit numbers written in the same felt pen as the smiley face and the WTF stuff. But there was something else amid all the graffiti, something that didn't stand out at first. Four words. That's that, mattress man. It was a quote from Yumiko's favorite movie, which was actually a favorite of mine as well, a movie by P.T. Anderson called Punch Drunk Love. I looked closely at the four-digit numbers again. There were no digits higher than six. I grabbed the Punch Drunk Love Special Edition DVD from my shelf. I'd bought it when I worked part-time at a video store. I hadn't watched a DVD in years, and wasn't sure I even had a way to play one. I dug up my old MacBook from school, and it booted up, no problem. I pressed play and started counting the time, stopping the movie when it matched up with the time each of the numbers could have represented. I followed the numbers in the pyramid clockwise. The first number was 1211. I wrote down the first line of dialogue in the film at the time, 12 minutes and 11 seconds. Adam Sandler's character Barry Egan says, "Sorry about that." I did the same thing for all of the other numbers, and when I was finished, I took the first letter of each word or sentence and found an ROT, or rotation code, that led to a phone number. The last four digits of that phone number? 6878. I called the number. It was a recorded message.
Dead people in gray were outside the building when I woke up.
It was Yumiko's voice. She sounded freaked out.
I ran out the side door and I didn't stop running until I made it back to the unit. It's amazing how long you can hang out on a university campus without anyone asking questions. I found this tape in a filing cabinet in the basement of a house that was scheduled to be torn down. They'd ripped out the stairs. I had to lower a rope into the basement. I'm going to play that tape for you now. Hold on.
Biology and behavior. What's the connection? Design and the environment. Nothing matters but this. Separating biology and the behavioral sciences from architecture is a fatal mistake. The bottom line isn't money or purpose. It's inspiration. It's biological architecture. The living home.
I know it's too dangerous to communicate with anyone. I'm sure that I'm myself anymore. Somebody's here. Someone don't care. Someone's here.
That's where the message ends. It was difficult to hear. It took me a while to process that recording. It was clear that Yumiko felt like she was close to discovering something. I need to find out what that something was, or is. It's Rabbits. I'm Carly Parker. We'll be back again in 2 weeks. Until next time, stay safe. If you enjoy Rabbits, you'll love our other podcast, Tanis. Tanis is a docudrama about an ancient and mysterious myth, perhaps the last genuine mystery of the information age. Download the podcast The Guardian calls compelling and wildly addictive at itunes.com/Tanis or tanispodcast.com. Tanis. It's television for your ears. Carvana is the new way to buy a car. Do you dread spending your Saturday haggling with a car salesperson? Well, I know that I do. I find the whole idea of negotiating at the car dealership stressful. With Carvana, you can skip the dealership and buy your next car online. Choose as soon as next day delivery or pickup from the world's first coin-operated car vending machine. Enjoy the peace of mind of a 7-day return policy, plus save some serious money compared to dealerships. Carvana is the new way to buy a car. Check out carvana.com/rabbits to learn more. That's carvana.com/rabbits. That's carvana.com/rabbit. Rabbits is a Public Radio Alliance and Minnow Beats Whale production. Produced by Hollis Adams Lane. Produced, mixed, and edited by Terry Miles and Carly Parker. Additional editorial and production assistance by Morgan Stevens. Associate producers Tara Pratt and Bailey Everett. Producer Emeritus Mackenzie Howard. Executive producers Terry Miles and Hollis Adams Lane. You can support Rabbits by visiting our website at rabbitspodcast.com and clicking on support in the top right corner. If you enjoy Rabbits, please rate and especially review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you found us. Reviews are key to keeping Rabbits on the charts where people can find our show. Thank you so much for listening to Rabbits. For legal and safety reasons, we've elected to change some names and leave others out entirely. We don't do this very often, but we're not willing to compromise people's safety for any reason. Thanks again for listening to Rabbits.